A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know that moment when you're sitting in a double-parked rental van, hazards flashing, watching the same Honda Civic circle past you for the third time, and you realize the thing you're actually moving isn't furniture. It's 40 linear feet of curb space that you don't own and nobody wants to give you.
That's the move. That's the whole move right there. Everything else, the lifting, the stairwell geometry, the furniture origami, that's secondary. The real bottleneck is whether you can legally occupy a strip of asphalt for 3 hours without getting towed, ticketed, or screamed at.
Here's the thing. Summer moving season is peaking right now. June, July, August. In most American cities, the temporary residential parking permits that used to be relatively easy to grab have gotten tighter since the COVID-era flexibilities expired. Cities aren't waiving fees anymore. They're not extending hours. They're back to enforcing with a vengeance.
I was looking at the numbers on this. In New York alone, the DOT processes something like 40,000 temporary move-in permits a year, but the approval window is 3 to 5 business days. If you're doing a last-minute move, which is most moves, you're already outside the system before you've packed a single box.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the fourth in this series we've been doing on urban self-moving with our professional movers. We've covered elevator access, the clipboard as a social engineering prop, and what you can legally push down a sidewalk without a motor. Now he's asking about vehicle loading and utilization. Specifically, how do you secure a viable loading zone for several hours when you don't have a commercial permit, a crew of 5, or a line item for municipal fines?
He's right that professional movers treat this completely differently than civilians do. I've talked to guys in the industry. In Los Angeles and San Francisco, moving companies literally budget $200 to $500 per move just for parking tickets. It's not a mistake they made. It's a standard operating expense. They've done the math, and a citation is cheaper than the labor hours they'd lose hunting for legal parking.
Which is a wild way to think about municipal code, as a pricing mechanism rather than a prohibition. But we're not operating with that budget. The goal here is to get maybe 80% of the professional outcome with about 20% of the overhead, using knowledge instead of money. And ideally without a single ticket.
The street, in this context, is negotiable real estate. And most people don't realize how much negotiating room they actually have. Not with the law itself, but with the humans who enforce it, the building staff who control access, and the specific wording of the ordinances that were written for commercial trucks and don't quite map onto a guy with a hatchback and a dream.
A guy with a hatchback and a dream. That's the title of my memoir.
Today, we're going to reverse engineer how this actually works. The permit landscape, the loopholes, the vehicle positioning tactics, and the social script you use when a parking enforcement officer walks up and you're standing there holding a box and sweating.
Because the single most valuable skill in urban moving isn't lifting technique. It's knowing exactly what to say in the 30 seconds between, "Is this your vehicle?" and the moment the ticket book comes out.
Let's frame what we're actually trying to solve here. In a dense urban core, the curb is the single most contested resource you don't own. A moving truck, even a modest box truck, needs roughly 40 linear feet of unobstructed curb space. That's 2.5 parallel parked cars worth of real estate, and you need it for 2 to 4 hours.
In most neighborhoods, that exact same stretch of curb is being fought over by delivery vans, rideshare pickups, residents who've been circling for 20 minutes, and 3 different food delivery apps all converging at once. You're not asking for a parking spot. You're asking for a temporary land grant in the middle of a turf war.
And here's where the asymmetry between professional movers and the rest of us gets really stark. Commercial moving companies don't just budget for fuel and labor. They budget for parking tickets as a standard operating expense. I've seen the internal line items. In Los Angeles and San Francisco, it's $200 to $500 per move, baked in. They treat citations as cheaper than the labor hours they lose hunting for legal parking.
Which reframes the whole thing. They're not avoiding tickets. They're pricing them. The fine isn't a penalty. It's a fee for a service the city doesn't officially sell.
And we're operating under a totally different constraint. No commercial budget, no crew of five, and ideally zero citations. The goal is to get about 80% of the professional outcome with 20% of the overhead, using knowledge instead of money.
This is different from what we talked about in the sidewalk staging episode, where the question was basically, how much stuff can you legally pile on a sidewalk and push with a hand truck? Vehicle loading introduces a whole new variable. The car itself becomes part of the negotiation.
The hatchback or SUV isn't just transportation. It's a mobile buffer, a legal prop, and in some cases, the thing that makes an enforcement officer pause just long enough for you to finish the trip you're already holding. The first thing to understand is that the permit system is both your friend and your enemy. It's designed for commercial operators, trucks with DOT numbers, liability insurance, and dispatchers who file paperwork 5 days out. But with a few tweaks, it works for us.
Walk me through the actual mechanics. If I'm moving out of a third floor walk-up in Brooklyn, and I want to reserve a chunk of curb for a Saturday, what am I actually doing?
New York City DOT issues temporary moving permits, officially called a temporary no parking permit, and you apply through their online portal. It costs between $35 and $75 depending on the borough. Manhattan's the most expensive, Staten Island the cheapest. But here's the catch that burns people. You need 3 to 5 business days of advance notice. They won't process it faster. If you're moving on a Saturday, you need to have submitted by Tuesday at the latest.
Which means the entire permit system is useless for anyone who found out Thursday night that their lease is up Sunday.
And that's most moves. I talked to someone who did it by the book in Brooklyn, reserved a 40-foot zone outside their building for a Saturday move, paid $55, posted the official sign 72 hours in advance. The truck pulled up, the space was there, it was beautiful. But they had to plan the move date 5 days out, which is a luxury most people don't have.
That's the gold standard if you have lead time. What about other cities?
San Francisco's SFMTA temporary parking permit is $62 for a full day. But, and this is the kind of detail that ruins your afternoon, if your reserved zone blocks a bike lane, even partially, you need a certificate of insurance naming the city as an additional insured. Most individuals don't have that just lying around. Commercial movers do. So you apply, they approve the zone, and then you realize the only viable stretch of curb in front of your building overlaps a bike lane by 2 feet, and suddenly you're in insurance purgatory. Chicago's O'Hare Zone is its own special nightmare. Separate rules, separate enforcement, and the residential permit parking system doesn't play nicely with temporary moving permits. If you're in a zone neighborhood, you're dealing with two different city agencies that don't talk to each other. I've heard of people getting ticketed by one while holding a valid permit from the other.
The permit landscape is basically, plan a week ahead, have insurance, and hope your city's left hand knows what the right hand is doing. That's a lot of hopes.
Which is why the loophole layer matters more than the permit layer for most people. Here's the thing. In almost every major American city, active loading is exempt from meter payment and standard time limits. If you are physically loading or unloading, you're not parked. You're engaged in a different activity entirely. It's doing all the work. Active is defined as continuous physical presence at the vehicle. If you walk away, even to carry a box into the building, the vehicle is now unattended and subject to the posted restrictions. If you're alone, you physically cannot be in two places at once. You load the dolly, you walk inside, you come back. And there's a ticket on your windshield because the vehicle was unattended for 3 minutes.
The solo mover is structurally excluded from the active loading exemption.
Structurally excluded, yes. Which brings us to the single most valuable piece of human infrastructure you can deploy on moving day, the curb watcher. This is a friend. Any friend, they don't need to lift anything, who sits in the driver's seat reading a book while you shuttle boxes back and forth. The vehicle is now legally attended for the entire duration. An enforcement officer walks up, sees a person in the driver's seat, and the whole interaction changes.
You're not arguing with the law. You're satisfying the law's definition of attended by putting a warm body in the seat.
That warm body doesn't need to know anything. They just need to be there and say, "We're actively loading. The driver's inside with a box. He'll be back in 2 minutes." That sentence alone has gotten people out of more tickets than any permit ever issued.
What about the commercial loading zones, though? The ones with the 15-minute limit and the official signs?
This is where it gets interesting. In Boston and Washington, D.C., commercial loading zones have a 15-minute limit, but there's no restriction on how many times you can return to the same spot. The language says 15 minutes per use, not 15 minutes per day or 15 minutes per vehicle. If you have a hatchback, you can legally do this, load for 15 minutes, drive around the block. That takes maybe 2 minutes. Return to the exact same spot and load for another 15 minutes. You've reset the clock.
That sounds exhausting.
It is absolutely exhausting, and it burns gas and time. But it's citation-free. You're following the letter of the law so precisely that no enforcement officer can write you up. You're not parked, you're loading. And when you're done loading, you leave and come back to load again.
There's something almost absurdist about doing laps around your own block with a car full of boxes just to satisfy the exact wording of a municipal ordinance.
Absurdist is the right word. But absurd and legal beats sensible and ticketed every time. And here's the thing. After 2 or 3 cycles, the enforcement officers on that route usually figure out what you're doing. And in most cases, they stop caring. They see the same hatchback, the same guy sweating, the same boxes, and they just drive past. You've established a pattern, and patterns signal legitimacy.
The loophole is self-reinforcing. The more you do it, the safer you get.
Now let me give you the flip side, the permit trap. Seattle's temporary moving permit costs $85 and it's valid from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. That's it. If your move runs past 6 p.m., which moves always do, you are now illegally parked with a valid permit. The permit itself becomes evidence against you. An officer sees the posted permit, checks the time, and writes the ticket because the permit's expired.
The thing you bought to protect you has turned into a countdown clock.
It's worse than that. If you'd never bought the permit and just used the act of loading defense, you might have been fine. But the permit establishes a specific time window, and outside that window you have no defense at all. You've paid $85 for the privilege of being ticketed with extra paperwork. That's the permit layer. Now let's talk about what you actually do with the vehicle itself, because how you position it changes everything about how the street sees you.
The hatchback is architecture.
A hatchback or SUV isn't a moving truck, it's a logistics hub. The key move is to create what I'd call a loading bay behind the vehicle. You're aiming for about a 10 by 10 foot staging area right at the rear bumper. Boxes come out of the building, they hit that zone, they go into the car. The vehicle itself becomes a mobile buffer between your operation and traffic.
In some jurisdictions, you can back the rear 3 feet over the sidewalk, if local code allows it, which creates a natural barrier. The car is now part wall, part workbench.
And that visual matters. A vehicle backed up to a building with a clear staging zone behind it reads as loading operation in progress to anyone who glances over, including enforcement, versus a car parallel parked normally with boxes scattered around it which reads as someone's making a mess.
Perception is half the enforcement equation.
More than half. Now here's a tactic that exploits a specific gap in most municipal codes. If you have access to a second vehicle, even a friend's sedan, you can do what I call the two-vehicle dance. Park your primary loading vehicle in the premium spot right outside the building. Load intensely for 30 minutes. Then swap it with the shuttle vehicle, which has been sitting in a legal spot 3 blocks away, and reset the clock entirely.
Because the time limit is on the spot, not on you.
Most cities don't have a same vehicle restriction, they have a same spot. Time limit. 2 different cars, 2 different license plates. As far as the ordinance is concerned, those are 2 separate parking events. You can cycle them all day.
That's the kind of thing that feels like cheating but is actually just reading comprehension.
I've seen it work. The shuttle vehicle doesn't even need to be big. It just needs to hold the space while you shuttle a load inside. Then the primary vehicle comes back. You're never parked illegally, you're never over any time limit, and you're never unattended.
Let's talk about the human element, because that's where most of this actually plays out. Parking enforcement officers are not robots. They have discretion.
And the research bears this out. Officers issue verbal warnings far more often than people realize, especially in active loading scenarios. The script that works, and I mean actually works, is this. You're mid-carry, you see an officer approaching, you set the box down or keep holding it, make eye contact, and say, "I'm just finishing up. 5 more minutes and I'm gone."
Not, "I have a permit." Not, "You can't ticket me." Just a clear, polite, specific timeline.
Here's why it works. You're visibly sweating, you're holding a box, you're clearly in the middle of something. The officer's job is to keep traffic flowing and curb access rotating. If you can credibly signal that you're about to vacate, most of them will give you those 5 minutes. The key is to never argue, never claim a permit you don't have, and always offer to move immediately if they insist.
Politeness as a get-out-of-jail-free card.
It sounds trite, but it's genuinely the most underutilized tool in urban logistics. Officers deal with angry people all day. Someone who says, "You're right, I'm over the limit, I'll move right now," is so rare that it often short-circuits the whole enforcement script.
Which brings us to the uncomfortable but practical reality, the municipal fine as a budget line item. Professional movers in LA and San Francisco budget $200 to $500 per move for tickets. For a DIY mover, a $165 citation is cheaper than renting a moving truck for a day, which runs $100 to $200, and way cheaper than hiring movers at $500+.
I'm not saying go out and get ticketed, but calculate your ticket tolerance before you start. If you're moving 10 boxes and each trip takes 5 minutes, you need 50 minutes of loading time. If the legal limit is 15 minutes, you'll need 4 cycles. Each cycle carries some risk. Decide up front, I will accept up to $130 in tickets for this move.
Because the thing that actually ruins moves isn't the $65 ticket. It's the panic. The panic makes you rush. Rushing makes you drop things. Dropping things makes the move take longer. And longer means more exposure.
There's one more piece of leverage most people completely overlook. If you're moving into or out of a building with a loading dock, the super or dock master controls that space, not the city. A $20 coffee gift card and a clear timeline. I need the bay from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. I'll be out by 2:15. Often works better than any permit. Building staff have de facto authority over their curb. They can tell enforcement you're authorized even if you're not on any city ledger.
You're not bribing anyone. You're tipping for the inconvenience of the mess you're about to make.
That's exactly the framing, and it's accurate. You are creating a mess, you are inconveniencing people, and a small gesture of acknowledgement goes a long way. I've seen supers wave off parking enforcement with a single hand gesture because they knew the mover and had been taken care of.
Let me give you a concrete example of how all this comes together. There was a mover in Chicago who used what I'd call a rolling staging area. They parked their hatchback in a 15-minute commercial loading zone, unloaded the entire car onto the sidewalk, legally, as long as pedestrian access was maintained, then moved the car to a legal spot 3 blocks away. The sidewalk pile was technically temporary storage, which most cities allow for up to 2 hours. They then shuttled boxes from the pile into the building over the next hour. The car was never parked illegally for more than 50 minutes, and the sidewalk staging was within the 2-hour window.
That's elegant. The car becomes a delivery mechanism, not a parking problem. And the sidewalk, which we covered in the earlier episode, becomes your actual staging infrastructure.
It's worth comparing this to how Europe handles the same problem. In Berlin, the Anwohnerparkausweis, the resident parking permit, gives you unlimited parking in your zone. But moving requires a separate Umzugsgenehmigung that costs 25 euros and takes up to 2 weeks to process.
For a piece of paper that says you're allowed to park a van outside your own building for 1 day.
The American system, for all its chaos and fragmentation and contradictory agency jurisdictions, is actually more flexible for last-minute moves. You can work the loopholes. You can talk to an enforcement officer. In Berlin, if you don't have that permit, there's no conversation. You're just fined.
The human element is more built in here. And that's really the second-order point of this whole discussion. The most successful DIY movers aren't the ones who memorize every municipal code section. They're the ones who understand that enforcement is a negotiation, not a fixed rule. The officer has discretion. The building super has authority. The loading zone sign has loopholes. Treat the whole thing as a set of negotiable constraints, and suddenly you have options you didn't know existed. Let's pull this into something you can actually use next weekend.
I love a numbered list. It's the sloth way. Structure, clarity, minimal movement.
Number 1. Before moving day, spend 30 minutes walking your route. Not driving it, walking. Identify 3 potential loading zones within 2 blocks of your building. Note the posted restrictions on each one. Time limits, permit requirements, tow-away warnings. Rank them A, B, and C by risk level. Your A spot is the one directly outside the building with the most forgiving signage. Your C spot is the fallback when the A spot is blocked by a delivery truck and the B spot has a film crew.
You do this reconnaissance on foot because you'll see things from the sidewalk that you miss from behind a windshield. The sign that's been turned around. The fire hydrant half hidden behind a planter. The loading zone that's technically commercial, but the stencil is so faded, you can barely read it.
Number 2. Build a moving day kit. A high visibility vest, the kind construction workers wear. It costs $8 and it signals, I am doing a job here, I am not loitering. A roll of blue painter's tape. Use it to mark your staging area boundaries on the sidewalk so pedestrians know where your zone ends and theirs begins. And $100 in small bills. Fives, tens, twenties. This is for expedited processing with building staff. You're not bribing anyone. You're tipping for the inconvenience of the mess.
Never call it a bribe. Call it thanks for accommodating the chaos. The words matter.
Number 3. If you're moving solo, the single most effective investment you could make is a $20 folding hand truck with pneumatic wheels. Not the hard plastic wheels. The air-filled ones that roll over curb cuts and sidewalk cracks without catching. This one piece of gear lets you move 4 boxes per trip instead of 2, which cuts your loading zone exposure time in half. And time is the currency of legal parking.
I'd add that the folding part matters. A hand truck that folds flat lives in your trunk forever, and you forget about it until the next move. A rigid one becomes a piece of furniture you have to store.
Number 4. Calculate your ticket tolerance before you start. Do the math out loud. If you're moving 10 boxes and each round trip takes 5 minutes, you need 50 minutes of loading time. If the posted limit is 15 minutes, you'll need 4 cycles. Each cycle carries some risk of citation, so decide up front. I will accept up to $130 in tickets for this move. Write that number down.
Because the thing that actually ruins moves isn't the $65 ticket, it's the panic spiral. Panic makes you rush. Rushing makes you drop a box of kitchen stuff. Cleaning that up adds 20 minutes, and now you're deeper into the violation window. The pre-committed ticket budget is a stress management tool disguised as a financial decision.
If you get through the whole move with 0 tickets, that $130 is still in your pocket. You didn't spend it. You just gave yourself permission to not panic.
That's the whole game, really? Permission to not panic, backed by a plan. Where does this leave us? I keep thinking about what happens when the curb isn't just contested by other humans, but by things that don't get tired, don't take coffee breaks, and don't respond to 5 more minutes, and I'm gone.
Autonomous delivery vehicles. San Francisco's already running dynamic curb pricing pilots. The idea that loading zones get priced in real time based on demand, like surge pricing for asphalt. A robot delivery van doesn't need to negotiate. It just pays the algorithm, claims the space, and moves on. The era of free or cheap curb access might be ending within 5 years.
Which makes everything we've been talking about, reading municipal code, social engineering with enforcement, tactical vehicle positioning, more valuable, not less. These aren't just moving hacks. They're urban survival skills for a world where the curb is becoming a priced commodity.
The person who knows how to talk to an enforcement officer, who understands the difference between attended and unattended in the municipal code, who can read a street and spot 3 viable loading zones on a single block, that person has an edge that isn't going away. Density's increasing. Curb space isn't.
If you found this useful, rate the podcast 5 stars and tell one friend who's planning a move. Next week in this series, how to move large furniture through narrow stairwells without damaging the walls, the physics of rotation, and the art of the furniture pivot.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The oldest known phonograph recording that can still be played back was etched onto a soot-covered glass plate in 1857 by French inventor Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville. 10 years before Edison's first recorded sound, and decades before anyone figured out how to actually play it back.
A recording nobody could listen to for 20 years. That's patience.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.